Chapter 12. It was a 2 days' walk to Ferrucci. The path meandered a great deal but tended always south, as well as I could tell by having the sun on my left in the morning and on my right at sunset. There were many channels through the grasslands and willow meads to wade or swim, holding my pack and shoes up out of the water on a stick. But it was easy walking otherwise, and my supply of dried fish cakes and salted cheese lasted me well enough. From time to time I saw the smoke of a cabin or a village off to one side or another, and a side path leading to it. But the main way kept on, and I kept on it. So late on the second day, the path turning left along the sandy shore of a great lake led me to a village. Pastures with a few cows, a few willows, a few little houses up on stilts, a few boats at the piers. Everything in the marshes repeated itself with a slightly varied sameness, an extreme simplicity. There were no children around the village, and I saw a man spreading out a fishing net. So I walked on between the houses and called to him, "Is this Ferrucci?" He laid the net down carefully and came towards me. "This is East Lake Village of Ferrucci," he said. He listened gravely as I told him the quest I was on. He was 30 or so, the tallest man I'd seen among the Rossiu, and his eyes were gray. I knew later that he was the son of a marsh woman raped by an Etran soldier. When I told him my name, he said his, Rava Atiu Sidoi, and courteously invited me to his house and table. "The fishermen are coming back now," he said, "and we'll go to the fish mat. Come with us, and you can ask your question of the women. It's the women who will know." Boats were coming in to the piers and unloading their catch. A dozen or more light boats with small sails that made me think of moth wings. The village began to come alive with the voices of men, and dogs, too. Dogs came leaping out of the boats to prance ashore through shallow water, slender black dogs with tight-curled coats and large bright eyes. The manners of these dogs were quite formal. They greeted one another with a single bark. Each investigated the other's other end while tail wagging vigorously. One of them bowed and the other accepted the bow, and then they parted, each following its master. One of the dogs carried a large dead bird, a swan perhaps. It went through no ceremonies with other dogs, but trotted off importantly along the beach, westward with its bird. And quite soon, all the men followed it, carrying their catch in nets and baskets. Rava brought me along with them. Around a grassy headland, in a little cove, we came to the women's village of East Lake. A number of women were waiting in a meadow at a large sheet of reed cloth spread out on the ground. A lot of children ran about the edges, but were careful not to set a foot on the cloth. Pots and reed cloth boxes full of cooked food were set out as if at a market. The men sat down and displayed their catch on the cloth in the same way, and the dog laid the bird down and stood back wagging its tail. There was a lot of talking and joking, but it was unmistakably a formal occasion, a ceremony. And when a man came forward to take a box or a pot of food, or a woman to pick up a net bag of fish, they said a ritual phrase of thanks. An old woman pounced on the swan, shouting, "Kura's arrow!" And that brought on more joking and teasing. The women seemed to know exactly which catch went to which woman. The men did a little more discussing over who got what. But the women mostly made it clear. And when two young men had an argument over a box of fritters, a woman settled it by nodding at one of the rivals. The one who didn't get them went off sulkily. When everything had been picked up, Rava brought me forward and said to the women in general, "This man came to the village today looking for his people. He was taken to Etera by the soldiers as a young child. He knows his name only as Gavir. People in the north thought he might be a Sidoyu. At that, all the women came forward to stare at me, and a sharp-eyed, sharp-nosed, dark-skinned woman of 40 or so asked, "How many years ago?" "About 15, Ma'io," I said. "I was taken with my older sister, Sallow." An old woman cried out, "Tano's children!" "Sallow and Gavir," said a woman with a baby in her arms, and the old woman, carrying the dead swan by its large black feet, pushed up close to study me and said, "Yes, her children, Tano's children, Enuamba and Nume." "Tano went for black fern, down the long channel," one of the women said to me. "She and the children, they didn't come back. Nobody found the boat." "Some said she drowned," another woman said, and another, "I always said it was the slave takers." And the older woman pressed forward still closer to look at me, looking in me for the woman they had known. The young women stood back, eyeing me in a different way. The dark woman who had spoken to me first had said nothing and hadn't come forward. The old woman with the swan went and talked to her, and then the dark one came close enough to say to me, "Tano Aitano Sidoy was my younger sister. I am Gegemer Aitano Sidoy." Her face was grim, and she spoke harshly. I was daunted, but after a minute I said, "Will you tell me my name, aunt?" "Gavir Aitana Sidoy," she said almost impatiently. "Did your mother, your sister, come back with you?" "I never knew my mother. We were slaves in Etra. They killed my sister 2 years ago. I left and went to the Danaran forest." I spoke briefly and said left, not escaped or ran away, because I needed to speak like a man, not like a runaway child, to this woman with her crow's face and crow's eyes. She looked at me briefly, intensely, but didn't meet my gaze. She said at last, "The Aitanu men will look after you," and turned away. The other women clearly wanted to keep looking at me and talking about me, but they followed my aunt's lead. The men were beginning to straggle back to their village, so I turned and followed them. Rava and a couple of older men were having a discussion. I couldn't follow all they said. The Sidoyu dialect was strange to my ears and contained a lot of words I didn't know. They seemed to be talking about where I belonged. And finally, one of them turned back to me and said, "Come." I followed him to his cabin, which was wood-framed with a wooden floor and walls and roof of reed cloth. I had no door or windows, since you could open up a whole side of it by raising any of the walls. Having put away the box and clay pot of food which he'd gotten from the women, the man raised the wall that faced the lake and tied it up on posts so that it extended the roof, shading that part of the deck from the hot late afternoon sunlight. There he sat down on a thick reed cloth mat and set to work on a half-made fish hook of clamshell. Not looking up at me, he gestured to the house and said, "Take what you like." I felt intrusive and out of place and didn't want to take anything at all. I didn't understand these people. If I was truly a lost child of the village, was this all the welcome they had for me? I was bitterly disappointed, but I wasn't going to show any disappointment, any weakness to these cold-hearted strangers. I would keep my dignity and act as standoffish as they did. I was a city man, an educated man. They were barbarians, lost in their marshes. I told myself that I'd come a long way to get here and might as well stay the night at least, long enough to decide where else I might go, in a world where evidently I belonged nowhere. I found another mat and sat down on the outer edge of the deck. My feet dangled a couple of inches above the mud of the lakeshore. After a while, I said, "May I know the name of my host?" "Metter Aitana Sidoy," he said. His voice was very soft. "Would you be my father?"
"I would be the younger brother of that one, your aunt," he said.
The way he spoke, keeping his face down, made me suspect that he wasn't so much unfriendly as very shy. Since he didn't look at me, I felt I shouldn't stare too much at him, but from the corner of my eye I could tell he didn't look much like the crow woman, my aunt, or like me. "And of my mother?" He nodded. One deep nod. At that, I had to look round at him. Metter was younger than Gegemer by a good deal, and not so dark and sharp-faced. In fact, he looked something like sallow, round-cheeked, with clear brown skin. Maybe that was what my mother Tano had looked like. He would have been about the age I was now when his sister disappeared with her two little children. After a long time, I said, "Uncle." He said,
"Oh."
"Am I to live here?"
"Oh."
"With you?"
"Oh."
"I'll have to learn how to live here. I don't know how you live." He said. I would soon be familiar with these grunted or murmured responses. "Oh" for yes, "eh" for no, and "uh" for anything between yes and no, but having the general meaning, "I heard what you said." Another voice made itself heard.
"Meow."
A small black cat appeared from a heap of something in the darkness of the hut, came across the deck and sat down beside me, decorously curling its tail round its front paws. Presently I gave its back a tentative stroke. It leaned up into my hand, so I continued stroking it. It and I gazed out across the lake. A couple of the black fishing dogs ran past on the lakeshore. The cat ignored them. My uncle Metter was, I noticed, looking at the cat instead of bending industriously over his work. His face had relaxed.
"Prout's a good mouser," my uncle said.
I kneaded the nape of the cat's neck. Prout purred. After a while, Metter said,
"Mice are thick this year."
I scratched behind Prout's ears and wondered if I should tell my uncle that for one summer of my life, I had eaten mice as a major part of my diet. It seemed unwise. Nobody had yet asked me anything about where I came from. No one in Ferusi ever would. I had been in Etera, where the slave takers came from, the robbing, raping, murdering, child-stealing soldiers. That was all they needed to know. I'd been elsewhere. They didn't want to know about elsewhere. Not many people do. It wasn't easy for me to ask them about Ferusi. Not that they didn't know all about it or didn't want to talk about it, but because it was their entire universe and was therefore taken for granted. They couldn't understand the kind of questions I asked. How could anybody not know the name of the lake? Why would anybody ask why men and women lived separately? Surely no one could think they should live shamelessly in the same village, the same house. How could anybody possibly be ignorant of the evening worship or the words to say when giving or receiving food? How could a man not know how to cut reed grass or a woman not know how to pound it to make reed cloth? I soon learned that I was more ignorant here than I'd been even my first winter in the forest, for there was a lot more to be ignorant of. City people might say that the Sidoyu were simple people living a simple life, but I think only a life as solitary, poor, and crude as Kuga's could be called simple. And even so, the word belies it. In the villages of the Sidoyu, existence was full, rich, elaborate, a tapestry of demanding relationships, choices, obligations, and rules. To live as a Sidoy was as complex and subtle a business as to live as an Etran. To live rightly as either was, perhaps, equally difficult. My uncle Metter had taken me into his house without any show of welcome, certainly, but without the least reluctance. He was quite ready to be fond of his long-lost nephew. He was a mild, modest, gentle man, embedded contentedly in the village network of duties and habits and relations like a bee in a hive, or a swallow in a colony of mud nests. He wasn't very highly considered by the other men, but didn't mind, not being restless or rivalrous. He had several wives, and that did earn him respect, though any relationship with women was, of course, set apart from the rest of a man's life. But if I try to tell what I learned about living as a Sidoy, as I learned it, slowly, in fragments, by guesswork, my story will go on and on. I must explain what I can while I get on with what happened. What happened was that I ate a good supper of cold fish cakes and rice grass wine with my uncle, his cat Prut, and his dog, Minky, a kind old bitch who showed up just in time for her supper. She put her graying muzzle on my palm very politely. I watched my uncle dance and speak a brief worship to the Lord of the Waters on the deck of his hut in the twilight, as other men were doing on the decks of their huts in the twilight, and then he unrolled a bed mat for himself and helped me lay out the sitting mats as my bed. The cat went mousing underneath the hut, and the dog curled up on her master's mat as soon as he unrolled it. We lay down, said good night, and went to sleep, while the last gleam of daylight was fading from the water of the lake. Before sunrise, the men of the village went out on the lake, one or two of them to a boat, with a dog or two. Metter told me that this was the season for great numbers of a fish called tuta to come into the lake from the seaward channels, and they hoped this morning might begin the run. If so, I gathered they'd be working hard for a month or so in both villages, the men catching the fish and the women drying them. I asked if I could come with them and begin to learn how they fished. He was the sort of man who finds it impossible to say no. He hemmed and mumbled. Somebody was coming that I should talk to, was all I could understand. "Is it my father who's coming?" I asked.
"Your father? Metter Sodia, you mean? Oh, he went north after Tano was lost,"
Metter said rather vaguely. I tried to ask, but all he would say was, "Nobody ever heard about him again." He got away as soon as he could and left me alone in the village with the cats. Every house had its black cat or several of them. When the men and dogs were gone, the cats ruled, lying about on the decks, wandering over the roofs, having hissing matches between houses, bringing kittens out to play in the sun. I sat and watched cats, and though the kittens made me laugh, I felt my heart very heavy. I knew now that Metter meant no unkindness, but I had come home to my people, and they were utterly strange to me, and I a stranger to them. I could see the fishing boats away off on the lake, the tiny wings of the sails on the silken blue water. A boat was coming towards the village. It was a big canoe, several men paddling hard. The canoe slid up to the muddy shore. The men leapt out, drew it up farther, and then came directly to me. Their faces were painted, I thought, then saw it was tattooing. All had many lines drawn from temple to jaw, and an older man's whole forehead to the eyebrows was covered with vertical black lines, as was the top of his nose, so that he looked like a heron, with a head dark above and light below. They walked with stately dignity. One of them carried a stick with a great plume of white egret feathers on top of it. They halted in front of the deck of Metair's cabin, and the older man said, "Gavir Aitana Sidoy." I stood up and reverenced them. The older man made a long statement which I didn't understand a word of. They waited a moment, and then he said to the man with the stick, "He hasn't had any of the training." They conferred for a while, and the man with the stick turned to me. "You will come with us for your initiation," he said. I must have looked blank. "We are the elders of your clan, the Aitanu Sidoyu," he said. "Only we can make you a man, so that you can do a man's work. You've had no training, but do your best, and we'll show you what to do." "You can't stay as you are," the older man said. "Not among us. An uninitiated man is a danger to his village and a disgrace to his clan. The claw of Enu Amba is against him, and the herds of Sua flee from him. So, come." He turned away. I stepped down from the deck among them, and the man with the stick touched my head with the egret plume. He didn't smile, but I felt his goodwill. The others were cold, stern, formal. They closed in round me, and we went to the canoe, got in, pushed off. "Lie down," Egret Plume murmured to me. I lay down between the rowers' feet and could see nothing but the bottom of the canoe. It, too, was made of reed cloth, I realized, heavy strips laminated across and across and stiffened with a translucent varnish till it was smooth and hard as metal. Out in mid-lake, the rowers lifted their paddles. The canoe hung in the silence of the water. In that silence, a man began to chant. Again, the words were completely incomprehensible. I think now that they may have been in Auritan, the ancient language of our people, preserved over the centuries in the ritual of the marsh dwellers. But I don't know. The chanting went on a long time. Sometimes one voice, sometimes several, while I lay still as a corpse. I was half in a trance when Egret Plume whispered to me, "Can you swim?" I nodded. "Come up on the other side," he whispered. And then I was being picked up by several men as if I was indeed a corpse, swung high up into the air and thrown right out of the boat head first. It was all so sudden that I didn't know what had happened. Coming up and shaking the water out of my eyes, I saw the side of the canoe looming above me. "Come up on the other side," he'd said. So I dived right down and swam under the huge shadow of the canoe, coming up again, gasping, just outside its shadow in the water. There I trod water and stared at the canoe full of men. Egret Plume was shaking his feathered stick and shouting, "Hee yee! Hee yee!" He reversed the stick and held out the plain end to me. I grabbed it, and he hauled me in to the side of the canoe where several hands pulled me aboard. The instant I sat up, something was jammed down over my head, a wooden box. I couldn't move my head inside it, and it came right down onto my shoulders. I could see nothing but the gleam of light from below my chin. Egret Plume was shouting, "Hee-yee!" again, and there was some laughter and congratulation among the others. Whatever had happened, apparently had happened the right way. I sat on a thwart with my head in a box and didn't try to make sense out of anything. I've told this much of the initiation because it isn't secret. Anybody can see it. The fishermen out on the lake had gathered near the war canoe to watch. But once I had the box on my head, we steered straight for the village where the secret rites were held. Ferusi was five villages, the one where I was born, East Lake, and four others strung out within a few miles along the shores of Lake Feru. They took me for initiation to South Shore, the largest village, where the sacred things were kept. The big canoes were called war canoes not because the marsh people ever fought a war, either against others or among themselves, but because men liked to think of themselves as warriors, and only men paddled the big canoes. The box on my head was a mask. While I wore the mask, I was called the Child of Enyu. To the Rasiu, the cat goddess Enume is also Enuamba, the black lion of the marshes. I can't tell more of the rites of initiation, but when they were all done, I had a fine black line tattooed from the hair above my temple down to my jaw, one on each side. I'm so dark-skinned the lines are hard to see. Once I was initiated and came back to East Lake, I realized that all the men had such lines down the side of their face, and most had two or more. And when I was initiated and came back to East Lake, I was one of them. I was an odd one, to be sure, since I was so ignorant. But the men of my village let me know they thought I wasn't totally stupid, probably because I showed promise as a fisherman. I was treated much as the other boys were. Normally, a boy came over from the women's village after his initiation at about 13, and lived with an older male relative for some years. His mother's brother, or an older brother, occasionally his father. Fatherhood was much less important than relation through the mother's family, one's clan. Here, in the men's village, boys learned the men's trades. Fishing and boat building, bird hunting, planting and harvesting rice grass, cutting reeds. The women kept poultry and cattle, gardened, made reed cloth, and preserved and cooked food. Boys older than 7 or 8 living in the women's village weren't expected or even allowed to do women's work, so they came over to the men's village, lazy, ignorant, useless, and good for nothing. Or so the men never got tired of telling them. Boys weren't beaten. I never saw a Rasiu strike another person, or dog, or cat. But they were scolded and nagged and ordered about and criticized relentlessly until they had learned a craft or two. Then they had their second initiation and could move into a hut of their own choice, alone or with friends. The second initiation wasn't permitted until the older men agreed that the boy had fully mastered at least one skill. Sometimes, they told me, a boy, refusing his second initiation, chose to return to the women's village and live there as a woman the rest of his life. My uncle had several wives. Some Rasiu women had several husbands. The marriage ceremony consisted of the two people announcing, "We are married," at the daily food exchange. Scattered along between two half-villages were some little reed-cloth huts, just big enough for a cot or mat, which were used by men and women who wanted to sleep together. They made their assignation at the food exchange or at a private meeting in the paths or fields. If a couple decided to marry, the man built a marriage hut, and his wife or wives came to it whenever they agreed or arranged to. I once asked my uncle as he left in the evening which wife he was going to, and he smiled shyly and said, "Oh, they decide that." As I watched the young people flirting and courting, I saw that marriage had a good deal to do with skill in fishing and skill in cooking, for a husband gives the fish to the wife who cooks it for him. That daily food exchange of raw for cooked was called the fish mat. The women, with their poultry and dairying and gardening, actually produced a good deal more of our food than the men did by fishing. But their butter and cheese and eggs and vegetables were all taken for granted, while everybody made a fuss over what the men provided. I understood now why Ameda had seemed ashamed when he cooked the fish I'd caught. Village men never cooked. Boys and unmarried men had to bargain or wheedle for their dinners, or take whatever was left on the fish mat. My uncle's taste in wives and cooks was excellent. I ate well while I lived with him. I spent the year after my initiation as an Aitan Sidoy of the Rasiu, learning how to do what the men of my people did. Fish, plant and harvest rice grass, and cut and store reeds. I was unhandy with a bow and arrow, so I wasn't asked to go out in the boat to shoot wild fowl, as boys often were. I became my uncle's net thrower. While we dragged the net, I fished with the rod and line. My knack for this was recognized at once and won me approval. Often we took a boy along to shoot, and it was the joy of old Minki's life to leap into the water after the duck or goose when he brought one down, fetch it back to the boat, and carry it proudly ashore, wagging her tail. She always gave her birds to my uncle's oldest wife, Pumo, and Pumo thanked her gravely. Planting and harvesting rice grass is the easiest job on earth, I think. You go out in autumn in a boat on the silky blue water over at the north end of the lake, where the rice islets are close together, and pull slowly down the tiny channels, tossing handfuls of small, dark, sweet-smelling grain in showers to right and left as you go. Then, in late spring, you go back, bend the tall grasses down into the boat from right and left, and knock the new seeds off the stems into the boat with a little wooden rake, till the boat's half full of it. I know the women sniggered at the fuss the men made about planting and harvesting rice grass, as if there were any skill to it, but they always received our bags of rice with praise and honor at the fish mat exchange. "I'll stuff you a goose with it," they said, and it tasted almost as good as Etrin grain porridge. As for reed cutting, that was hard work. We did a great deal of it in late autumn and early winter, when the weather was often gray and cold or raining. Once I got used to standing all day in water 2 or 3 feet deep and to the angle of the curved scythe and the triple rhythm of cutting and gathering and handing, for you must gather the reeds together before they separate and drift off on the water and hand the long, heavy bundle up into the boat, I liked it well enough. The young fellows I went out with were good companions, rivalrous about their own prowess as cutters, but kind to me as a novice, and full of jokes and gossip and songs that they shouted across the great reed beds in the rainy wind. Not many of the older men went reed cutting. The rheumatism they got from doing it as young men kept them from it now. It was a dull life, I suppose. But it was what I needed. It gave me time to mend. It gave me time to think and to grow up at my own pace. Late winter was a pleasant, lazy time. The reeds had been cut and handed over to the women to make into reed cloth, and there wasn't much for the men to do unless they were boatmakers. Nothing bothered me but the damp, foggy cold. Our only heat was from a tiny charcoal fire in a ceramic pot. It made a very small sphere of warmth in the hut. If the sun was shining, I went to the shore and watched the boatmakers at their work, a refined and exacting skill. Their boats are the finest art of the Rasiu. A war canoe is like a true line of poetry. There's nothing to it that is not necessary. It is purely beautiful.
So when I wasn't huddled over the fire pot, dreaming, I watched the boat grow. And I made myself a good set of rods and lines and hooks, and fished, if it wasn't raining hard, and talked to my friends among the young people. The women didn't set foot in the men's village, or men in the women's village. We had, after all, the rest of the world to meet in. Men and women got to talking at the fish mat, and out on the lake from boat to boat, for the women fished too, especially for eels, and in the grasslands inland from the villages. My luck in fishing helped me make friends among the girls, eager to trade their cooked food for my catch. They teased me and flirted mildly, and were happy to walk along the lake shore or an inland path, a few of them with a few of us young men. Real pairing off was forbidden until the second initiation. Boys who broke that law were exiled from their village for life. So we young people stayed together as a group. My favorite among the girls was Tiso Betu, called Cricket, for her pinched little face and skinny body. She was bright and kind and loved to laugh, and she tried to answer my questions instead of staring at me and saying, "But Gavir, everybody knows that." One of the questions I asked Tiso was whether anybody ever told stories. Rainy days and winter evenings were long and dull, and I kept an ear out for any tales or songs. But subjects of talk among the boys and men were limited and repetitive. The day's events, plans for the next day, food, women, rarely a little news from a man from another village met out on the lake or in the grasslands. I would have liked to entertain them and myself with a tale, as I had Brigand's band and Barna's people. But no one here did anything like that at all. I knew that foreign ways, attempts to change how things were done, weren't welcomed by the marsh people, so I didn't ask. But with Tiso, I wasn't so afraid of putting a foot wrong, and I asked her if nobody told stories or sang story songs. She laughed. "We do," she said. "Women? Oh. Men don't?" "Hey," she giggled. "Why not?" She didn't know, and when I asked her to tell me one of the stories I might have heard if I'd been a little boy growing up in the women's village, it shocked her. "Oh, Gavir, I can't," she said. "And I can't tell you any of the stories I learned?" Hang, she murmured. No. I wanted to talk to my Aunt Gegemer, who could tell me about my mother. But she still held aloof from me. I didn't know why. I asked the girls about her. They shied away from my questions. Gegemer Aitano was, I gathered, a powerful and not entirely beloved woman in the village. At last, on a winter day when Tiso Betu and I were walking in the pastures behind the rest of the group, I asked her why my aunt didn't want anything to do with me. "Well, she's an Ambamer," Tiso said. The word means marsh lion's daughter, but I had to ask what that meant. Tiso thought about it. "It means she can see through the world and hear voices from far away." She looked at me to see if I knew what she was talking about. I nodded, a little uncertainly. "Gegemer hears dead people talking sometimes, or people who aren't born yet. In the old women's house, when they do the singing, Enu Amba herself comes into her. And then she can walk all across the world and see what's happening and what's going to happen. You know, some of us do some of that kind of seeing and hearing while we're children, but we don't understand it. But if Amba makes a girl her daughter, then she goes on seeing and hearing all her life. It makes her kind of strange, you know?" Tiso pondered for a while. "She has to try to tell people what she saw. The men won't even listen. They say only men can have the power of seeing, and an Amba Mer is just a crazy woman. But Mother says that Gegemer Aitano saw the poison tide. When the people who eat shellfish in the western marshes got sick and died, a long time before it happened, when she was just a child. And she knows when people in the village are going to die. That makes people afraid of her. Maybe it makes her afraid of them. But sometimes she knows when a girl's going to have a baby, too. I mean, even before she is. She said, "I saw your child laugh, Yenny." And Yenny cried and cried. She was so happy, because she wanted a child, and she'd never got one. And a year later, she did. All this gave me a great deal to think about, but it still didn't answer my question. "I don't know why my aunt doesn't like me," I said. "I'll tell you what Mother told me, if you won't say anything to any of the other men," Tissot said earnestly. I promised silence, and she told me. Gegemer tried and tried to see what happened to her sister Tano and her babies. For years, she tried. They had singings for her, and that went on and on. She even took the drugs. And an Amba Mer shouldn't take the drugs. But Amba wouldn't let her see her sister or the children. And then, you came walking into the village, and still, she didn't see you. She didn't see who you were until you said your name. Then everyone saw. She was ashamed. She thinks she did something wrong. She thinks Amba is punishing her because she let Tano go alone so far south. She thinks it was her fault the soldiers raped Tano and sold you and your sister. And she thinks you know this. I was about to protest, but Tissot forestalled me. "Your soul knows it, not your mind. It doesn't matter what your mind doesn't know if your soul knows. So you are a reproach to Gegemer. You darken her heart." After a while, I said, "That darkens my heart." "I know," Tissot said sadly. It was strange how Tissot made me think of Sotor. Utterly different in everything, they were alike in their quickness to feel pity, to understand grief, and not to say too much about it. I gave up the idea of trying to approach my aunt through her armor of guilt. I longed to learn more about her powers, and Tissot's saying, "Some of us do that kind of seeing when we're children," had intrigued me. But the limits drawn around men's knowledge and women's knowledge were nearly as clear as the lines separating the half-villages. Tissot was uneasy about having said so much to me, and I couldn't press her further. None of the other girls would let me ask about sacred stuff at all. They hooted like owls, or yattered like kingfishers to drown me out, half alarmed at my transgression and half laughing at me for being, as they said, such a tadpole. I was reluctant to ask the boys my age what they knew about these powers of seeing. I was different enough already, and talking about such things would only estrange me further. My uncle left all mysteries alone, seeking comfort only where it was easy to find. I didn't know any of the older men well. Rava was the kindest, but he was an elder, an initiator of his clan, and spent much of his time in South Shore. There was only one man I thought might welcome my questions. Pirok was old, his thick hair quite white, his face seamed and drawn. He was crippled with rheumatism, and lived, I think, in pain. His arthritic hands were not good for much, but he laboriously knotted and mended fishing nets, and though he was slow at the work, It was always done perfectly. He lived by himself in a tiny house with a couple of cats. He spoke little, but had a gentle manner. He was often too lame to go to the fish mat. Tissot's mother sent food for him, and I offered to take it to him. It became a regular thing that she'd give it to me, and I'd take it and set it down on the old man's deck and say, "From Lali Betu, Uncle Pirak." We young men called all the old men uncle. He'd be sitting in the sun, if there was any sun, working at a net, or just gazing over the grasslands, humming. He'd thank me, and as soon as I turned away, the soft humming would begin again. Soon, half-comprehensible words would enter into the tune, strange song words about the marsh lion, the lords of the fish, the heron king. They were the only serious songs I had heard in Ferrusi, the only ones that hinted at a story behind them. One day, I put down his reed box of food and said, "From Lali Betu, Uncle Pirak," and he thanked me, but I didn't turn away. I stood by his deck and said, "Can I ask about the songs you sing, Uncle?" He glanced up at me and back at his work, then laid the net down and looked at me steadily. "After the second initiation," he said. That was what I'd been afraid of. There was no arguing with the rules of the sacred. I said, But he saw I had a second question and waited for it. "Are all the stories sacred?" He gazed at me a minute, thinking, and finally nodded. "Oh, so I may not listen to you sing?" "Eh," he said, the soft negative. "Later, when you've been to the king's palace." He looked at me with sympathy. "You'll learn the songs there, as I did." "The Heron King?" He nodded, but murmured, "Eng, eng," with a gesture to prevent my asking more. "Later," he said. "Soon." "There are no stories that are not sacred?" "Those the women and children tell. They are not fit for men." "But there are tales of heroes, like Hamneda, the great hero who wandered all the length of the western shore." Pirak gazed at me a while and shook his head.
"He did not come to the marshes," he said, and he bent to his work again.
So all my tales and poems remain closed up in my head, silent, as my copy of Caspero's poem lay closed and wrapped in reed cloth in my uncle's house, the only book in all Ferrusi, unread. I was fishing by myself one day in spring. My uncle had gone netting with another man. Old Minki jumped into the boat as a matter of course and sat in the prow like a curly-eared figurehead. I put up the little sail and let the wind carry us slowly up the lake. I didn't net, but fished with the rod and line for Ritta, a small bottom fish, sweet and succulent. The Ritta were lazy, and so was I. I gave up after a while and just sat in the boat, drifting. All around me was the silken blue water, and in the distance a few reed islands, and beyond them the low green shore, and far in the distance, a blue hill. So I had come round to the earliest and oldest of all my rememberings or visions, and was in the memory, the vision itself. Remembering that, I began all at once to remember other things, I remembered the streets of cities, the lights of houses crowded over a canal, the dark cobblestones of a steep street in the winter wind. There was the fountain in front of Archimond, and there was a tower over a harbor full of ships, and there was a tall house with red rain-beaten walls, all in a rush and tumult of images, dozens of visions all crowded into one another and then sliding away, ungraspable, gone, leaving nothing but the blue sky and water, the low green shore, and the distant hill where I had been all my life and was now again, this once, in this one moment. The visions lessened, faded. Minky looked around, towards home. I sailed slowly back to the village. People were already gathering for the fish mat. I had only a couple of little Rita to offer, but Tissot and her mother always had something cooked for me. I took my portion and Pirox and went back to the men's village to Pirox's house, where he sat mending a fine net. I set his portion down and said, "From Lali Betu, may I ask you a question, uncle?"
"Huh?"
"All my life, I've seen through the world. I've remembered what I had never yet seen, and been where I've never yet been." He had raised his face and was looking at me gravely. I went on. "Is this a power of our people, of the Rasiyu? Is it a gift or a curse? Are there any people here who will tell me what my visions are?"
"Yes," he said. "In South Shore. I think you should go there."
He got up laboriously and stepped down off his deck. He came with me to Metair's cabin. My uncle was sitting eating his dinner, with Minky on one side thumping her tail on the deck, and Prut on the other, with his tail wrapped round his paws. My uncle greeted Pirok and offered him his dinner to share.
"Gavir Aitana, in kindness, brought me food from the fish mat," the old man said. He spoke very formally. "It is well known that there have been great seers in your clan, Metair Aitana. Is this not so?"
"Oh,"
my uncle said, staring.
"It may be that Gavir Aitana has the power. It would be well that the keepers of the sacred things be told this."
"Huh?"
my uncle said, staring at me now.
"Your net will be ready tomorrow," the old man said, in a different tone of voice, and turned to limp back to his cabin.
I sat down near my uncle and began to eat my own dinner. Tissot's mother had made excellent fish cakes, rolled up in lettuce leaves with a drop of hot pepper sauce.
"I suppose I'd better go to South Shore," my uncle said. "Or should I talk to Gegemer first, I wonder? But she's... I suppose I should just go. I don't know.
May I go with you?" Minky thumped her tail.
"That might be good," my uncle said, with relief.
So the next day we sailed to South Shore Village, where I'd been initiated. Metair seemed to have no idea what to do once we got there. So I led off to the big house, where the sacred things were stored and initiations were held. It was the biggest house I'd seen in the marshes, with walls of rigid lacquered reed such as they built the war canoes of, and a high reed-bundled roof. The fenced court in front of it was bare earth, with a small pool and a great old weeping willow tree beside it. The building was very dark inside, and awesome with the memories of the initiation rites.
We didn't dare enter or even speak. We waited by the pool until a man came into the court. I had been about to suggest that we find some members of our clan, the Aitanu, and ask them for advice or assistance, but my uncle went over to the man and began at once to tell him that he was here with his nephew, who had the power of seeing visions. The man was one-eyed and had a rake broom in his hand. He had evidently come to sweep the courtyard. I tried to prevent Metter from babbling to somebody who appeared to be the janitor, but he babbled on. The man nodded and looked more and more important. At last he said, "I will tell my cousin Dorad Aitana, the seer man of Reed Isles, and he perhaps will find if your nephew is suitable for training. Enuamba has guided your steps to this place. Go with me." "With me," Metter said gratefully. "Come along, Gavir. It's all settled." He couldn't wait to get away from that big house with its dark open doorway. We went straight back to the docks and got into our boat, which Minky had been guarding by lying curled up asleep in the stern, and sailed home. I didn't put much credit in the one-eyed man's boasts. I thought that if I wanted to find out anything about my visions, I'd have to do it myself. So I got up my courage, and at the fish mat that evening I approached my aunt, Gegemer. I traded a good catch of Ritta with Cora for a goose he'd shot, a fine, fat bird which I cleaned and plucked carefully. I'd seen men who were courting women make such an offering, and so I offered it to Gegemer. "I need advice and guidance, aunt," I said more bluntly than I'd intended. She was a formidable woman, hard to speak to. At first she didn't answer, or take the goose from me. I could feel her recoil, her wish to refuse. But she put out her hand at last for the gift and gestured with her head to the gardens, outside which men and women often met to talk. We walked there in silence. I arranged in my mind what I'd say, at least to start with, and when she stopped by a row of old dwarf cherry trees and faced me, I said it. "I know you're a woman of power, aunt. I know you see through the world sometimes, and walk with Enuamba." To my great surprise, she laughed. A surprised, scornful laugh. "Ha! I never thought to hear that from a man," she said. That took me aback, and I hesitated, but managed to go on with what I'd planned to say. "I am a very ignorant person," I said. "But I have two kinds of power, I think. I can remember very clearly what I've heard and seen. And I can remember, sometimes, what I have not yet heard and seen." There I stopped. I waited for her to speak. She turned away a little and rested her hand on the gnarled, scaly trunk of a little tree. "And what can I do for a man of power?" she asked at last, with the same hostile scorn. "You can tell me what the visions are, how to use them, how to understand them. Where I was, in the city, in the forest, no one had this power. I thought if I could come back to my people, maybe they'd tell me what I need to know. But I think no one here can or will. Except you." She turned quite away from me at that, and was silent for a long time. At last she turned round and faced me. "I could have taught you, Gavir, if you'd been here as a child in our village," she said, and I saw she was holding her mouth tight to keep it from quivering. "It's too late now. Too late. A woman can't teach a man anything. Wherever you've lived, you must have learned that." I said nothing, but she must have seen my protest in my face and that she'd hurt me. What can I say to you, sister's son? You come by your gifts truly. Tano could tell any tale she'd heard once and repeat words she'd heard years before. And I have walked with the lion, as you say, for all the good it's done me. To bring back the past in memory is a great power. To remember what hasn't yet come to pass is a great power, too. What's the use of it, you ask me? I don't know. I've never known. Maybe the men know, who look down on women's visions as meaningless foolishness. Ask them. I can't tell you. I can only say, hold to the other power, the one your mother Tano had, for it won't drive you crazy. She wouldn't look at me steadily. Her glance was fierce and black as a crow's. I heard how like my own voice hers was. What's the good of remembering all the stories I ever heard, if men aren't allowed to tell stories or hear them? I said, my thwarted anger rising to meet hers. No good, she said. You should have been a woman, Gavir Aitana. Then one of your powers might have brought you good. But I'm not a woman, Gegemer Aitano, I said bitterly. She looked round at me again, and her expression changed. No, she said, nor quite a man yet, but well on the way. She paused and drew a deep breath, and finally said, I'll give you what advice I can, though I think you won't take it. So long as you remember yourself, you're safe. When you begin to remember farther, you begin to lose yourself. You begin to be lost. Don't lose yourself, Tano Aitano's son. Hold to yourself. Remember yourself. No one told me to do that. No one but me will tell you to do it. So take your risks. And if I ever see you when I walk with the lion, I'll tell you what I see. That's the only gift I might have to give you. In return for this. And she swung the dead goose by its webbed red feet, and scowled, and walked away. A little later in the spring, when the weather was getting very warm, I came back one afternoon with Minky and my uncle from fishing and found two strangers sitting on the deck. One of them was tall and heavy-set for a Rossiyu, dressed in a long, narrow robe of fine reed cloth bleached almost white. I thought he must be some kind of priest or official. The other man was shy and silent. The man in the robe introduced himself as Dorad Aitana and named off a litany of our clan relationship. Meter scurried off with our catch to the fish mat, since Dorad said it was me they came to talk to, and he was glad to get away from strangers. When he had gone, Dorad said to me, smiling but with authority, "You came to South Shore seeking me." "It may be that I didn't know it," I said, a fairly common phrase among the marsh people who avoid direct negatives and unnecessary commitments. "You have not seen me in vision?" "I believe I have not," I said humbly. "Our ways have been coming closer for a long time now," Dorad said. He had a deep, soft voice and an impressive manner. "I know you were brought up among foreigners and have only been in Ferusi for a year. Our kinsman at the big house in South Shore said to tell me that you had come at last. You seek a teacher. You have found him. I seek a seer. I have found him. Come with me to my village, Reed Isles, and we will begin your training. For it is late, very late. You should have been learning the way of the visions for years now. But we will make up for lost time. For time is never lost, is it? We will bring you into your power, maybe within a year or two, if you give all your soul to it. Your second initiation, then, will not be as a mere fisherman or reed cutter, but as a seer of your clan. There is no seer of the Aitanu now, not for many years. You have been long wanted, long awaited, Gavir Aitana. Of all he said, it was those last words that went to my heart. Who had ever waited for me to come? A stolen child, a slave, a runaway, a kind of ghost to my own people, a stranger everywhere else. Who wanted or would wait for me? I'll come with you, I said.